everyone. I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And we are historians. And if this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians and other victims of the research bug.
We're going to talk to these archive addicts about what kinds of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what was their funniest or saddest or most frustrating or most illuminating experience in the archives.
And once again, we'll be asking the question, what madness is this?
We'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which Eve and I are presently enjoying occupancy in what we call Melbourne today, that is the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, whose land was stolen and whose sovereignty was never ceded.
Today on Archive Fever, we're talking to Margot Neal and Lynn Kelly, who are co-authors of the 2020 book Songlines, The Power and Promise. Margot is based at the National Museum of Australia, where she holds the titles of Senior Research Fellow, Senior Curator, and Principal Indigenous Advisor. She curated the hit 2017 exhibition, Songlines, Tracking the Seven Sisters, which gave audiences an immersive encounter with Indigenous songlines, and which is now touring nationally and internationally. Lynn Kelly is a science writer known as the Memory Whisperer. She's an expert on the memory techniques used by oral cultures, and her 19 books include The Memory Code and Memory Craft. Most recently, Margot and Lynn have been working together to bring the power and promise of Indigenous knowledge systems to a general public. Their co-authored book, Songlines, is the first in a new series on First Knowledges, which will be edited by Margot Neal, and the book was shortlisted for the 2021 Victorian Premier's Literary Award. Welcome to Archive Fever, Margot and Lynn.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Songlines is the culmination of a long career thinking about Indigenous knowledge systems and archiving. Now, we'll talk more about the specific ideas in this book in a moment, but first I'd like to go back to where it all began. What were the origins of your interest in these ideas, or where did you first get bitten by the archive bug? Margot, would you perhaps like to answer first?
I think it's in my DNA. I'm, you know, Aboriginal and Irish descent on the Aboriginal side from both the Kulin and Woombunga nations, a true, as I say, fringe dweller of the British Empire on both accounts. In terms of archive, I don't ever remember not thinking about it, although that word wasn't the word we would have used, but the idea of knowledge is Indigenous knowledges and the land being the, you know, as Lynn would call it, mnemonic system, it was always a text to be read. And clearly in the more colonised south, we read it differently and had to learn a different way of speaking and reading. So it's a dynamic culture, as you know. So there were lapses along the way where one wasn't being overtly Aboriginal for all the obvious reasons. And so for me, the country's always been... the archive, and unlike Lynn, I'm absolutely hopeless in the paper archives. So I do most of my research archivally, orally, and visually. I'm now I set up a centre called the Centre for Indigenous Knowledges. So I'm head of that, which came out of the Songlines thing, which came out of, you know, people used to call our stuff myths and legends and fables and so on. And of course, that's all now transpired or expired, let's say, and being called knowledges, and so we have taken that on. We always knew that. It was just in recent years, really, that other people have seen that those stories we had were not bedtime stories. They were our way of carrying and holding our knowledge.
And what about you, Lynn? When did you first get bitten by the archive fever bug? Was it back in your childhood or early adulthood?
Childhood, I've always been mad keen on researching anything, but I was blessed with the world's worst memory. My natural memory is appallingly bad, and I say blessed now because I wouldn't be sitting here if it wasn't for that. So years and years of writing science books and education and that, I was looking into Indigenous knowledge systems on animals and plants and things and realised that they knew thousands of plants and animals and variation and all the scientific detail and astronomy and navigation and laws and all this stuff being kept in memory when I struggle with the day of the week. I was doing a PhD theoretically on writing about the animal knowledge, and I just started asking, how the hell do they do it? And that led me to exploring mnemonic technologies of Indigenous cultures, and we have by far the best resource in the world here in Australia with such a long culture to be able to teach us. So my theme became, I don't want to learn about Indigenous cultures, I want to learn from them and how on earth they're doing this. And songlines are the key.
And in the opening pages of your co-authored book, Songlines, you kind of establish the idea that songlines essentially are a kind of library or archive. To quote, songlines are foundational to our being, to what we know, how we know it, and when we know it. They are our knowledge system, our library, our archive, from which all other subjects are derived. Margot, could you unpack this idea for us? How exactly are songlines an archive, and what are they even exactly?
I think you can visualise songlines as corridors or pathways of knowledge crisscross the continent and linear, and it's only by travelling country that you can learn about country which you need to survive in country, especially in the desert regions or any region for that matter. It's sort of conceptually a worldview more than the Western archive, which is sort of generally tends to be written into books and then stuck in a big square box on a piece of land that has nothing to do with all the stuff that's in the library, right? So our Inuit fella once said to me, you know, trouble with them white fellas, they keep all their brains in books. The opposite to that, in fact, they're everything you need to know to survive both physically, spiritually, history, like your ancestors, morally, every other term you want, is all written into the land, and then, of course, you'll learn to read the land, and that means you've got to do it with elders and you've got to travel the land. So it's an immersive learning. And, of course, the song lines connect the nodes of knowledge, a rocky outcrop, an escarpment, a water hole, a hill depression, if you like, nodes of knowledge are like, I think Lynn will call them memory places or palaces or something like that, but it is that. They're almost places where you deposit knowledge, you know, you perform it, you invest it back into that place and you withdraw from it. And then like a little mobile library, you keep trundling along to the next node knowledge, depending on your age, your experience, your teacher, it's all age graded. Then the person becomes the mobile library. So you don't even have to be back in country to access it because you sort of have it as country in mind and you rehearse it through paintings. But mostly performances are the primary mode of knowledge transmission. But songlines, as you know, was invented as a term by Bruce Chatwood in 1987. Some people like to poo part of that, but I don't think it actually captures the essence of it in a cross-cultural way. Like it's a bit of a cross-cultural passport because people say jukuba, you know, dreamings, which is also a Western word, and all that, but no one can kind of grasp it. Now, you never grasp it. It's totally indefinable. I mean, we're just shooting the breeze really here because you can't really explain it. So this is just a gamification. Locally, different mobs will have different words for it. You know, as you'll have heard of Jukupa, and there's all sorts of others, and it's very regionalised. Even though songlines will stretch the continent, in fact, in the case of the Seven Sisters ones, they've stretched not only this continent but the whole world, because anywhere you can see the Orion and Pleiades, there will be a story. And invariably it's about sisters, seven or however many, because black fellows used to just say 1, 2, 3, big mob in the old numeric system. And you find this story everywhere, but it's always invariably to do with gender relations and appropriate ways of behaving and conducting yourself. That's why the male pursuer and it's very timely, actually, isn't it? When the Songlines exhibition opened in September 17, I was running around saying, oh, we preempted the Me Too movement. Of course, now with the local what do we call this movement?
The March for Justice or the Enough is Enough movement?
The March for Justice. Therefore, it is a universal story that's played out and will play out forever after, but it'll just manifest itself differently.
Lynn, I'd like to pick up on something Margot said there about the Inuit fellow who said that the problem with white fellows is their brains are kept in books. And you write in this book that songlines are an embodied knowledge system. I'm interested in this because white Western academics and intellectuals are often accused of being disembodied, you know, like out of touch with their wider senses and particularly their sexual sides, of always living in their heads to the detriment of their connection with life and the living. We sometimes refer to that derisively as eggheads or brainiacs or highbrow. So can you tell us what the relationship between songlines and our brain's synapses actually is? Why do our brains love narrative, as you say? And how is knowledge carried and transmitted to others by the human body?
Right, you've got about five different aspects there. I could talk forever on them. But the neuroscience of the human brain, you would swear that Aboriginal cultures knew all that umpteen thousand years ago and developed a system that matches it perfectly. For example, with the synapses, the relationship between a place and memory is only been strongly linked in the last decade or so. And the 2014 Nobel Prize for Medicine went to the researchers that showed that the human brain works on place cells, so it associates information with location. It was discovered by the ancient Greeks, they keep telling us, if you read all the books. It wasn't. Songlines represent this, a way of associating knowledge with nodes or locations or sacred places or in memory palaces, we call them loci or locations. If you think of something at the same time as you're at a place, your brain will link them. But we stop doing this, whereas Indigenous cultures all over the world do it constantly. And that strengthens memory massively for knowledge. And I've only glimpsed this. I have never lived it, so I can only be talking as a glimpser. But if you add the other strong memory techniques, song is far more memorable than prose. Acting out something, performance, as Margot keeps emphasising, you will remember a performance far easier than you'll remember a page in a book. And the performance of the knowledge at a particular place, incorporating song, dance and narrative, because our brains love narrative and it loves dramatic narrative, not wimpy narrative. So if you're at a location and you've got song, dance, narrative and entertainment plus emotion, emotion is another strong memory device, whack them all together, you have got unforgettable information. And Margot can probably do this better than me. Margot, can you do the skeleton but each performance adds flesh bit?
Yes. You know, you hear our mob saying, you know, the law never changes, it's immutable. And yet in another breath we say, well, we're a dynamic culture. We keep adjusting to changing circumstances. Otherwise, you know, we wouldn't still be here 65,000 years later. So we have this sort of skeletal template, right? There's a template of law. Some spell it O-R-E, others A-W, but there's this template of law that is indeed immutable. Yet along the way and along the journey, the details will change, the colouring will change, or the shape of the flesh that hangs off it will change. It'll be more or less flesh, but the actual frame or template always stays the same. And it's just a great story. I mean, it's a bit of a long story, so I'll try to say it all, but, you know, basically a mob set out with a whole lot of rangers and artists and all sorts of people. At the beginning of this journey along this creek, it was a woman's story, and by the end of the day it's a man's story. And the two dingoes who were the creators of this dry riverbed was at the beginning of the story of the day, was, you know, a male and a female. And then at the end of the day, the grey-haired one was the older brother and the lighter one was the younger brother. There's a hill there that one of the artist's fathers told a story about the brother, and there was all these details, but I won't go into. But over the day in the location, the whole story changed. People say, how can that be? You know, it can be, because even this other story that changed, I subsequently discovered, was a story before. But the mnemonics, or that particular hill and that river bed with those particular two individuals who were leading it, and they had a brochure with a picture of one of the fathers had done way, way back, and the whole thing just went bang, 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 and all of a sudden the story switched right over. But the meaning or the metaphor or the purpose of the story hasn't changed. There's a white fella driving, there's two Aboriginal people in the car, they're driving along the Canning Stock Route, and these two Aboriginal fellas, 40s, 50s, that sort of age, and they were driving along one, they're going, no, 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 and every now and then they'd stop, they'd look this way or that way, and then they'd see something, they'd go, no, 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 start singing, right? And then at one point, one of the Aboriginal men said to the white fellow who's driving, hey, stop here, there's a water hole. See that escarpment over on the left? And the other side of that escarpment is a water hole. And the white fellow said, wow, you've been here before. I didn't think you'd been there. No, no, I haven't been here. How do you know? It's in the song. My auntie taught me that song. It's in the song. You know, so he was most sceptical. So they got out of the car and they scrambled up the escarpment, got over the other side, and there was a water hole. Well, the Aboriginal people were the slightest bit surprised, and the white fellow was extremely surprised. So, you know, that's a really good example of a songline and operation. And that's in a walking country.
So, Margot, just quickly, I'm interested in picking up that idea of the flesh and the bone and the skeleton. Does that mean that the body is an archive?
Absolutely. And this goes back to your question about the embodied knowledge system. So this, if you didn't go to the Seven Sisters Songlines exhibition, I actually built it in, even though people won't necessarily know that you go in there and you look, lie on your back and you look up at a dome, then you look down at a projection on the floor, and then you look along paintings, and there's all this. So the whole way through this exhibition, you have to use your body in ways other than the normal Western run along a line of paintings eye level. But that goes back to this idea that the performance, the dancing stuff that you see the women in the desert do, that is the primary mode of transmission because of the rhythm and the tone. So there's lots of, it's a bit like, I guess, how Chinese language is tonal, how the different nuances of the body and its movement, as well as the nuances of the sound, transmit knowledge that may not be overtly articulated.
Another archive you talk about in the book is the third archive, which is a concept that you develop bringing in each of your kind of a Western and Indigenous perspective. Can you explain to us what exactly the third archive is and why it's so important?
Well, the reality of life is we all live together now, multicultural, all black, white, yellow, whatever. It's almost noble savage story to go around talking about how we have this pure, pristine sort of thing and nothing's ever changed in our archives, you know, and people do venture into that terrain, as you may know. And then you'll get the other end of that where we're all corrupt and our culture's dead and useless because it's so corrupted by white fella stuff. It's really a bit meaningless and just all motherhood statements. And, you know, they're two extremes. There's a lot of ground in between. Just like the word is songlines, as I said, or dreamings are a cross-cultural passport into each culture. Everything we do, in fact, is a third archive, because like the exhibition is a third archive, right? It's Indigenous knowledge systems, Indigenous stories, but they're done on canvas and labels are in English and a hybrid, you know, for want of a better word. And the same with they do native title tribunal or reports or anything, and that's, again, a combo of the creation of a third archive. Bangara's performances are a third archive. That's neither of each of the other.
It's a fascinating concept because it also goes to, as you're saying, the strength and resilience of Indigenous culture and knowledges. I was fascinated by your argument that colonisation was actually a struggle over archive. You write, Margot, taking the land was also taking the archive, destroying our identity and raison d'etre. Not the colonisers could have conceived of such an alien concept as an archive in the land. So do you see the creation of this third archive as being part of a post-colonial or a decolonising strategy?
I don't know what decolonising means. It's just a flavour of the month term that covers anything you wanted to cover, really. What we've got to remember is that even pre-white fellas and Macassans or Chinese or all the others who have come to the shore, but were only visitors, they didn't stay. Even prior to that, you've got Aboriginal groups who are of 350 different language groups. And so they're all cross-fertilising too. So we can't be as simplistic as saying all Aboriginal people and then all others who meet and then create this third archive. We have to remember that the adaptation to other peoples was a very real event within this continent before the Westerners arrived. So this concept of rubbery archive was perforated, whereas allowing, in fact, a form of third archive amongst different Aboriginal groups in the same way as if you envisage a map of Europe. Everyone looks at the Italians, the Spanish, the German, all kind of look the same. They all speak this funny kind of language and dance and sing. So people might see all them as the Europeans as one mob, but, of course, as we all know, like with the Aboriginal mob, each of those little countries throughout Europe are the same as each of the different Bundjalung or Wiradjuri or so on. So it's always the inter-archival kind of fluidity that I speak of in Western, you know, black and white terms is also an ongoing process from black to black. And, of course, white people never think of land being an archive. We wouldn't go blowing up things, would you? You wouldn't go blowing up the National Library of Australia because there's a gold seam under it.
And, Lynn, you write beautifully in the book how you didn't just learn about songlines. You actually created your own to help you learn French and then Chinese. And, you know, you talk really evocatively how that kind of changed your emotional relationship to your local neighbourhood. I'm interested in this idea generally of, you know, white settlers creating their own songlines. Is this something we're all sort of welcome to do, or could it be regarded as a form of cultural appropriation? Like, how should we as Westerners interact with songlines?
I think if we call them songlines and then say that we're doing exactly the same as Indigenous cultures, that would be rubbish. But what we can do is learn from Indigenous cultures all these mnemonic memory techniques that we have lost. So little kids sing their alphabets and then we stop them singing. Little kids play with characters and toys and makes up stories, and then we stop them, put that away, sit down at your desk and learn. So I've got 10 kilometres of songlines, or memory palaces as the Western term. Let me differentiate. The Western term memory palaces comes from the ancient Greeks, the method of loci, L-O-C-I, meaning location. Each location, they associate information. So memory champions, I've done memory competitions, will remember what they need at each place. The ancient Greek orators like Cicero on that would memorise what they needed, but they didn't then layer more and more and more complexity on top. Whereas a songline were laid down, which grounded the information literally, and then layer and layer of commentary and further knowledge with initiation and debate and argument and all the things that I'm told started with the Greeks, philosophy, science. I keep being told they started with the Greeks. It didn't. It's everywhere in the songlines. So I've got about 10 kilometres. I've got 1,000 digits of pi, totally useless, but I had to show I could do it. I've got songlines I use for French and for Chinese, and they're implemented differently because they're different ways of learning the languages. But I've also got all of history. If I walk out the front door, I start at 4,500 million years ago and walk around the block, I get to 1,000 and walk around the block. And now if you mention any time in history, my brain, any date, my brain will go to that place and I can look around and see the stories that I've created there and I act them out. I've got all the countries in the world. India, I imagined a full Bollywood production there and I get down and I Bollywood away and then all the information I want to add about India, I can layer on top of that storyline that started. It's a completely different way of knowing, and from somebody with the world's worst memory, I still have a bad natural memory, I can memorize anything and then layer more and more information. And that's what songlines do. So I've started doing this with schools and universities. We don't have to change anything in our curriculum. We can just enrich it massively by adding these techniques in, learning from Indigenous cultures. Our curriculum at the moment says about, I think, but it has to be from.
If these mnemonic memory devices are so incredibly powerful and useful, why did they fall out of use in Western cultures, do you think?
It's called writing. Socrates, who didn't write, Plato quotes him as saying, if you start using writing too much, you will lose these methods. Mm. And people then say to me, why do we need them? We can Google anything. You can't be creative by looking for something that already exists. The more you store in your memory, the more patterns your brain will start making and you'll start meshing it. Indigenous cultures, and I'm hoping Margot's happy with me saying this, but Indigenous cultures mesh all the different genres of knowledge. We like putting them in silos. And most of my life I've been in the physics, maths, IT silo. And so this was mind-blowing for me to discover it. I had to rethink the way I think. And it was so exciting. Firstly, writing, and now technology. And I'm working with a neuroscientist at the University of Western Australia, Dr. Jenny Roger, and she works on plasticity. And not only is she amazed how much everything she knows matches what Indigenous cultures have done all along anyway, but our brains do not stop losing these methods. And they have people at 100 years old still laying down new neural networks. What we're doing is stopping using our brains properly and letting them decay early. So we desperately need to learn these methods and implement them right through life.
I'm prepared to give it a go, Eve. What about you?
I know, I'm just thinking back to all the languages I failed to learn over the years. Maybe I should revisit German with a songline.
Yeah, I failed languages badly at school, but people who read the memory code kept writing to me saying, how do we apply this to languages? In the end, I gave in and decided I had to and found it worked so well for French. Why not take on Chinese? But I am enjoying the process. I'm out walking. I do it on my daily walk around my memory palaces. I'm creating wild stories and I'm having fun and I'm emotionally engaged with it. That's why it works so much better.
It also sounds like a recipe for never getting Alzheimer's. So you can throw away the Sudoku and just create a memory palace of your neighbourhood.
Well, I'm working with researchers in Europe on this very topic. Alzheimer's and dementia has a whole lot of different forms.
Yeah.
But they're certainly showing that using the person's home before they go into care, setting it up as a memory palace and then taking that virtually into care with them is making a massive difference. It's very new research, but it's incredibly promising, the results they're getting. There's research of dementia people that are non-responsive. They play familiar music or they take them to a familiar place and they respond. And there's so many examples of it. That's exactly how Indigenous cultures work. Music associated with place, song lines.
So, Margot, I just want to ask that if country holds all knowledge, if it's the wellspring from which all knowledge originates, and as you write, gives rise to the expression, our history is written in the land, clearly that's a massive archive. I'm interested to know, is it continually being added to or passed or amended as the country itself transforms, or is the archive static and immutable, as we tend to see that Western archives are? You know, there's the boxes over there. You don't go and add to the boxes after the boxes have been filed away.
Clearly not static and immutable because, you know, our mum went through the Ice Age and all sorts of climatic and, you know, continental shifts and clearly it can't be static or survival would be not possible. There's areas of land that people are no longer on. If you're not on the land, you don't sing the land, you don't perform the land, if you don't worry for it because it's your mother, if you want a simplistic relationship, it's like your mother. And if you ignore relationships with people and things, they disappear. It's the same with country. So because people are moved from country, and so the land kind of dies spiritually. So you've got to reoccupy. Maybe it's a different generation. They've got to reoccupy, re-nourish. And so caring for country is not just clearing water holes, but they've got to sing to the country, put the power back into the country, talk to it. We're coming, we're here, we're not going to hurt you. And so if you do that, then you spiritually nourish the country. Now, different generations and different people are going to come and do it in different ways. So what they get back out of the country will be different. So to answer your question, it's totally changing constantly, but the principles are the same.
It's interesting, if I can just mention Patrick Nunn's work. He's shown some of the stories on landscape changes date back 17,000 years. Scientists are only just discovering, rediscovering what Aboriginal people have been telling them of areas that were rainforests that are now different. So they maintain the original knowledge and add to it, volcanoes and islands and everything. That information we know is robust for 17,000 years. Now compare that to Stonehenge, a mere 5,000 years ago. I mean, it's a baby. That's how robust these methods are to keep information accurate. That's why they survived so well.
We'll pop a link on the Archive Fever website to some of the works that you've referenced in this fascinating conversation today. We could talk about this for ages. Obviously, it's so fascinating, and I'm sure some of our listeners would like their actual tips as to how they can use these mnemonic devices to improve their own memories and to learn, as you say, from Indigenous knowledges, not about Indigenous people. And if they go to the book songlines, many of these techniques are explained. And of course, if they go to your specific works, Lynn, on the memory code, they will be able to find that as well. And we'll pop links on the website to all of these works and some of the books that you've also referenced. You'll find that all on the Archive Fever website. But before we wrap up today, we might just ask one question that we ask all of our guests on Archive Fever. We'll ask it to you, Lynn. Is there a dirty little archive secret that you have that you would like to share with us?
Yes, there's things that aren't in the book. And in particular, my problem is coming from a really hardcore science, physics, maths, skeptical perspective. Characters make a huge difference. And as a mathsy, sciencey person, I wasn't used to interacting with people so much. And in my studio, which I'm now pointing to, is about 50 dolls and bears. And each one of them represents something different. And they all sit around my desk. Other people find it really spooky, all looking at me. So one doll in particular doesn't agree with my hardcore skeptic. And she keeps telling me, look, be careful. Other people are much more sensitive and have more spiritual beliefs than you. Just be careful of them. Another one insists I read everything out loud because I use convoluted sentences and convoluted syntaxes. And she makes me read it out with the rhythm right. So all these dolls and bears have a role. They're my audience and I couldn't write any books without them. But don't tell anyone. But don't tell anyone.
So it's almost like this whole thing is an argument for the importance of the humanities and storytelling. They're essential to human knowledge. And soft toys.
We've got to do what Indigenous cultures do. We've got to mesh them and we've got to bring in the humanity into everything.
I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. Thanks so much to Margot and Lynn for coming along to the Archive Fever studios. And until our next therapeutic session, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded and produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri land. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you choose to listen.
Our theme music is by Poddington Bear. You can hear more at soundofpicture.com. And to learn more about Lynn and Margot's work, you can follow Lynn on Twitter at Lynn_Kelly, and you can follow Margot at Margot Neal. And Claire's on Twitter at Claire A. Wright.
And you can follow Eve on Twitter at Eve Rees. So until the next episode of Archive Fever, happy researching.
Coming up on the next episode.
I'm often looking at artifacts and documents, and I think I use both of those sources a lot in my work. The sorts of things that many of us encountered and seen for the first time. But, you know, now that I work at the Australian National Maritime Museum, I've got a submarine in my archive. You know, literally, it's just out my window.